This is Tax Update for Saturday, August the 26th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, August the 26th, 2006. This week we look at But My Kids Are Worth It, the problem with children on the payroll. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at a recent case that came down, Alexander v. Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Case 2006-127. And this week's case gives us an opportunity to discuss the issues of hiring family members to work in your closely held business, or in this case, in your sole proprietorship. And we're going to discuss this in kind of a different view than we did back in February when we discussed the successful case of a taxpayer who was able to hire her spouse in her business and give them a medical reimbursement plan. In this case, we look at what not to do and how to do it wrong in the case of Alexander. Now, the Alexanders wanted to put their children on the payroll, and there's a number of reasons why parents like to put their kids on the payroll. One of the obvious ones is normally that the children's tax bracket is lower than the parents. So by paying the children a salary out of the parents' business, we get a tax deduction on the parents' Schedule C. Then we get to pick up that income on the children's individual returns, hopefully at a lower rate. Or maybe even, if the income is low enough, at a rate that's not subject to tax at all. So we can take cash essentially out of the parents' income, which may be subject to not only the regular income tax, but also the full-blown self-employment tax if their income is not above the limits for FICA for the year. And we may be able to take that and move that down onto the children as payroll expense. As well, the children are granted some special breaks there. If you hire your children in your unincorporated business, your Schedule C, you are not required to withhold FICA or Medicare or pay other payroll taxes on those particular wages. Rather, you just have to withhold the federal taxes, report the W-2s, but you get out of the payroll taxes. Again, remember, mom or dad, whoever is the owner of the business, is likely getting hit for the self-employment tax that involves a rate of upwards of over 15% on top of their income tax rate. So this break from FICA for those under age 18, the children under age 18, is a significant break that can be very useful to an individual with an unincorporated sole proprietorship. As well, if the children have earned income, they can go ahead and fund retirement accounts using those salaries to justify the contribution. Given the long-term growth the funds are going to benefit from, that could be a significant tax benefit in the long term. And with the addition of Roth IRAs to the mix a few years ago, it's become very popular in these cases to make sure and have the children fund a Roth IRA because their income is low enough that if there is any tax due, it's relatively low, and we can get fully tax-free growth in the funds, never subject to tax down the line, if we go ahead and put it into a Roth IRA. Finally, the employees may even be able to receive various benefits that are not available to the self-employed individual directly. Remember, in the hiring the spouse option we talked about in February, we were able to employ the spouse and offer the spouse a medical reimbursement plan. Now, with children, that's not going to be as likely to work simply because, A, we can't fund their parents as their dependents, and B, it's a lot tougher to justify reasonable compensation if there are significant medical expenses, and if the medical expenses aren't significant, it's difficult to justify the bother of setting up the medical reimbursement plan. But nevertheless, they are employees, and employees are generally treated better for purposes of employee benefits than are the self-employed themselves. So, given all those things, what do we need to do to justify a deduction for wages paid to the children? Well, the key to make sure payments qualify is to ensure they meet the same basic test that all business expenses have to meet under Section 162. And 162 starts out, one of the first things it discusses are wages. As 162 discusses, there should be allowed as a deduction all the ordinary and necessary expenses paid or incurred during the taxable year in carrying on any trade or business. And then, under 1, goes on to tell us that includes a reasonable allowance for salaries for personal services actually rendered. Now, for children, there's going to be two key concepts there. First, is it a reasonable salary? And secondly, did they really perform useful services to the business? As well as an issue we have to worry about of, was this really related to the business? Because the IRS will also like to go back and claim the wages really represent a personal expense that is non-deductible under Section 262A. And that provides that, except as otherwise provided in this chapter, no deduction shall be allowed for personal, living, or family expenses. So you have to be able to defend the fact that this is not a 262 expense, but rather represents an expense under the regular provisions that would be subject to a self-employed individual's business, just as if they were paying to an unrelated third party. Now, payments to children are especially subject to scrutiny due to the fact the parties are closely related. So we most often don't have a true arm's length transaction going on here to separate the payment of the wages where the parties each negotiate. You know, the employee negotiates a wage payment they want to take, and the business decides how much they're willing to pay. That's the traditional routine, certainly the routine that goes on when I hire employees here who are not happen to be related to me, but are just run-of-the-mill employees that you have in your business. You generally figure out that, and they're figuring out when they decide to go to work for you whether or not what you're offering seems to be in line with what would be reasonable for them under those circumstances, or whether they might do better elsewhere. Is it worth it to them to work for the amount that you're offering to give them? Well, the children obviously are in a different position. Mom and dad have somewhat of influence over whether the children will accept this position. As well, mom and dad have some reason to perhaps want to pay the children more than might be reasonable under the circumstance, because mom and dad may be able to control those funds anyway. And the issue, which we discussed earlier with the tax advantage, make it pretty obvious what you'd like to be able to do in this situation. So for that reason, payments to the children in the business are subject to special scrutiny. In the court case we're going to look at today, the court itself came up with 5 factors that it indicates would go to show that a wage payment was not necessarily truly a wage payment in the trade or business, but actually was just disguised payments for some other purpose for the children. And it's important to take a look at those 5 factors, because these are 5 things important not to do when you try to put your children or even your spouse on the payroll as an employee for whatever purpose. First key problem, failing to pay the employment taxes and file the information returns with regard to the children. Even if the children are exempt from FICA and FUTA because they're under age 18 and they're exempt due to the fact they're being employed directly by their parents, there is still the minor issue that you have to file for W-2s and we have to do any other reporting that is required. If you fail to do those reports, then it begins to look like maybe, you know, you're not treating this as real wages. I don't know what your experience has been, but my experience has been with my employees. They tend to want to see the W-2 as soon as possible after the end of the year. And I'm pretty sure that that's one of my key priorities at the end of the year, is to make sure the W-2s are issued for my employees. Well, if you never quite get around to doing the W-2s, that raises questions. Even worse, if the child's over age 18, or you're an S corporation or some other entity where we still have to pay the FICA, if you're not filing the 941s at all and paying over the FICA or the FUTA, that also seriously suggests that you didn't see these as wages, and in fact argues against it because you've already admitted to not treating them as wages in this regard. So for payroll tax purposes, apparently it never occurred to you to have the payroll tax reports and the payroll taxes paid. Second problem, paying the child a flat amount determined at the beginning of the year that's not based on the actual services performed. If the children all amazingly get paid just enough money so that they use up their standard deduction, or perhaps use up their standard deduction. Maybe you want to fund a deductible IRA for them for some reason, so it's their standard deduction plus the deductible IRA. If that's the magic number that gets funded to the kids, and that seems to be decided at the beginning of the year, and, oh, by the way, we have four kids that supposedly work in the business, but amazingly, they all earned exactly the same amount of money, even though it becomes apparent they could not have all worked exactly the same amount of hours nor had exactly the same value to the business. In those cases, we have a potential issue with justifying these are truly wages. They look like something else. A lack of correlation between the dates and amounts of the actual payments for the wages and the hours worked by the child. If the kids get paid evenly throughout the year, but they work at different times, for instance, if you have a child away at college, you write him a check every month, and then you try to classify that as wages at the end of the year, even though the child only worked in the business during the 3 months of summer, we begin to question whether those are truly wages. Similarly, if we seem to be advancing funds to the children whenever they need money for purchasing something or whether they need money for some specific event, which has no real relationship with when they're performing the services, and we try to reclassify those as wages, we may also have a problem. Number four was failing to maintain adequate records of the child's hours worked and the amounts earned. Employers usually maintain very detailed records and earnings records on all their employees, keeping track of exactly how many hours everybody works and tracking exactly what they're earned and what they're owed. Both the employer and the employee tend to be very interested in this information and making sure it's kept on a current basis. If you're not keeping that information or you're not keeping that information tracked for your children, it again suggests this is not a true employer-employee relationship and maybe this payment is something else. Finally, number five, it's not a good idea to be compensating the child for services that are in the nature of routine family chores. If it looks like part of what you're paying the child for, or a significant part of what you're paying him for, is just the routine chores expected of children every day for no pay, then the courts are likely going to argue that we have a 262A expense, non-deductible, and not a deductible expense in your business. So it becomes important to be able to show that the items being done and the things being performed are truly related to business requirements and are not related to other things that just happen to be needed around the house, like picking up around the house or cleaning up in the area. That can become doubly problematical if you have an office in home where the lines between what is personal and what is business might blur just a bit. But again, you need to be careful in that area. Now let's go on and take a look at the actual Alexander case. The case of Alexander at first glance seems to be a textbook case of the old adage that pigs get fatter, hogs get slaughtered in the tax realm. Because the Alexanders certainly seem to be going whole hog in this situation. When you look at their facts, it's tough to imagine a worse set of facts at the front end, even ignoring the facts that the court will finally concentrate on to disallow the deduction. The fact that the businesses the children worked for both had losses, and in both cases the losses were generated by the children's wages, was not a good fact. Although the court did not specifically mention that factor in disallowing the wages, but it still seemed awfully interesting that essentially the kids magically showed up and did work to remove the income from these two activities that otherwise had a positive cash flow. Now, there are two sets of children to work with here and two different businesses. The first business was a seamstress business run by Mrs. Alexander. That business had the assistance of her 21-year-old son, Stephen, who worked in that business over the summer when he was back home from college. So Stephen was away from home most of the years. He worked 3 months in the summer and then went back to college afterwards. Now, the work he did, they testified, included purchasing supplies, drafting sewing patterns, and cleaning his mother's workspace. Now, Mrs. Alexander testified on the stand that at the beginning of the year, she decided she could afford to pay Stephen $4,000, which happened to be exactly what was paid to him. Now, Stephen, being over age 18, would have been subject to FICA and FUTA on those wages paid by his mother. However, his mother never filed a Form 941 or 940 to report those wages, and similarly did not issue Stephen a W-2 at the end of the year. A couple of very not good facts. The tax court, not surprisingly, sided with the IRS in disallowing the deduction for Stephen's wages in full. They didn't just reduce them down to a reasonable level. The tax court essentially said, we're throwing the whole thing out. They considered a Cohen case issue here and maybe using a Cohen rule, but decided and pointed out that you can only use the Cohen rule if there's a reasonable basis for doing the allocation of business versus personal. And in this case, they felt they had no evidence of the breakdown between the personal work that Stephen may have done and the business-related work. Therefore, there was no way they could apply the Cohen standard. Now, the court noted in detail, on the basis of all the facts and circumstances, they conclude the payments to Stephen represented personal living or family expenses. That is, the official disallowance was under Section 262A. The tasks that Stephen performed are mostly in the nature of routine family chores, the court pointed out. The court went on to note petitioners determined the amount they would pay him and failed to observe the formalities of the employer-employee relationship, such as paying employment taxes, filing information return, and paying Stephen promptly for the hours he worked. Oh, minor detail. During the year, Stephen was paid $481 during the period from January through April. Remember, when he was away from home totally, not doing any work for the business. And then $2,256 in November and December when he again was not doing work in the business, was away from home and at college. So a significant part, in fact well over half of the wages paid to Stephen, were paid to him during the period when he wasn't doing the work. The amount paid during the period he actually was available to work in his mother's business was a much smaller amount. The court decided the petitioners cannot deduct the payments to Stephen as a wage expense in Mrs. Alexander's seamstress business. Now, they had another business too, and the Alexanders, in addition to their son Stephen, had three daughters. One was age 17, one age 9, and one 8. The daughters worked with Mrs. Alexander in a dog breeding business that she had. Now, Mrs. Alexander claimed a deduction for $4,250 for wages paid to each of the three girls, giving us a total of $12,750. As all of the daughters were under age 18 for the year in question, there was no FICA or FUTA due. But again, they failed to issue W-2s for their daughters. The court also noticed that the wages that were paid to the daughters happened to be exactly the amount of the standard deduction available for that year for each of the children to use to shield the entire amount of payment from income. Again, the wages dwarfed the income from the activity. While the dog breeding business had more income, in the case of the seamstress business, it had only $1,300 of wages, and Stephen had $4,000 of wage expense, the vast majority of the $4,666 that the entire enterprise had as expenses. In this case, the seamstress business generated income of $4,900, but had expenses of $16,007, of which, remember, $12,750 of that were the daughter's wages. Again, the business is profitable if we ignore all of the dollar's wages. Again, it's kind of an off-to-the-side, very small business, but is profitable cash flow-wise. It's not profitable if the daughter's wages are related, just as the same with Stephen's. Those wages are going to switch us from profit to loss. Well, they considered, in this case, though, the Alexanders went one step further. While Stephen got cash payments, now admittedly not at the time he did the work, but he got payments during years, the daughters didn't get payments. Rather, they kept a running total of the daughters' earnings during the year, and whenever the daughters wished to purchase certain items, their account was charged for the amount of the purchase. Now, the daughters were allowed to overdraw the account during the year, so if they didn't have enough in their account and they wanted something, it could go in the hole. That was treated as advanced on the earnings. Now, the daughters' duties were outlined as cleaning the dogs and the yard in which they exercised, putting up fencing for the dogs, taking out the garbage, and caring for newborn puppies. Mrs. Alexander at one point testified that she had decided to pay the daughters $7 an hour. That's how they set the rate, apparently having gotten the clue that having testified she got the number up front for Stephen wasn't necessarily a good thing. But the court noted at another point she had again determined what she could pay at the beginning of the year, and that was how she set the wages in one description, but then later said, no, I agreed to pay them $7 an hour. Now, the court indicated it found the $7 an hour testimony not credible that was supposedly related to the work the girls did, because it would have been a tremendous coincidence for two things to have happened. One, for every daughter to have worked exactly the same hours to get the magic $4,258 in wages. And number two, for them to have worked exactly the number of hours to get $4,250 in wages, which happened to be the amount of the standard deduction which they could receive without paying tax. The court again sided with the IRS and disallowed the wage deduction. In this case, the court noted that, again, based upon the facts and circumstances, they're going to go right back to Section 262A and disallow the deductions. It points out that, again, no W-2 was issued, and the court found they had, again, predetermined the amount they would pay for their daughters. The court decided that the tasks the daughters were performing were mainly routine family chores, as far as they could tell. Most likely, the judge decided it really probably didn't seem like work for little girls to take care of newborn puppies and to deal with the dogs. That didn't look much like work. That looked more like the sort of thing you might have trouble keeping them from doing. And I think the court doesn't mention it, but it also seems a little difficult to believe that the value of the work from the 18-year-old, the 9-year-old, and the 8-year-old would have been identical. It doesn't seem plausible to believe that the 9- and 8-year-old could be as productive as the 18-year-old, but nevertheless, that seems to be what the family had decided or was claiming when they went to court. Now, finally, the Alexanders tried to recover this by saying, but we asked the IRS about this, and we were told by a representative of the IRS that everything was fine. Well, as we've discussed before, even if that's true, that someone from the IRS had blessed the transaction and said, oh, that's great, you called the helpline, and they said, yeah, there's no problem, you can pay the wages to your kids, and I know all the facts you've told me, and based on those facts, I see, you know, it'll be no problem whatsoever, it would be sustained automatically. Even if an IRS employee had said that, and the court seemed to have some doubt whether that was the case, the court pointed out that generally you cannot rely on such statements if they are contrary to the law. The IRS is not bound by them. So if an employee gives an erroneous interpretation of the law, the IRS does not have to go along with that. The court went on to note that the only conditions where that would not be true is in extreme cases to justify equitable estoppel. And in those cases, the court noted five issues that would have to be shown by the Alexanders in order to be able to claim undue reliance upon the statements of the IRS employee, and that reliance should be held against the government because it was wholly detrimental to them. First, they must show a false representation or wrongful misleading silence by the party from whom the opposing party seeks to invoke the doctrine. So it would have to show that the IRS either basically told them the wrong stuff, was falsely represented the facts, or kept silent when they should have said something, so held something back. An error in a statement of fact and not in an opinion or statement of law. Ignorance of the true facts. Reasonable reliance on the acts or statements of the one against whom they're going to try to claim the estoppel against, in this case the IRS, and the adverse effects or acts of the one against whom the estoppel is claimed. And therefore, they have to show that we were adversely impacted in a way that wouldn't have otherwise happened. In addition, the court noted that in this case, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and this particular case, what was in the small tax court, so it would not have been appealed anywhere, the court is still going to apply the rules that the Ninth Circuit would apply if the case was subject to appeal, requires the party seeking to apply the doctrine against the government to prove affirmative misconduct. In this case, they failed all of these tests. They could not show that these activities had taken place, that they met these burdens, and for this reason the court held that even if they had been told about this, that's tough luck. In reality, had they not paid the wages, they would have owed the tax. Had the IRS employee told them the correct thing, they still would have been in the same position. So, regardless of anything else, it seems as if there's no real damage here from what the IRS told them. The only damage is that they didn't get out of paying taxes like perhaps they may have thought they were going to based upon what they had been told. What are the lessons of the Alexander case? Well, pretty easy in one sense to dismiss Alexander result as a case that proves the old tax adage that pigs get fatter and hogs get slaughter. As their fact patterns seem to be going far into the hog category. But it's still important to note the concepts the court outlined. Remember back in February we discussed in the podcast the case of Speltz versus Commissioner, TC Summary 2006-25. Now that was a case where the taxpayer prevailed in showing that her husband was a true employee, and in that case the key problem there and the key issue there was being able to get a medical expense reimbursement plan for her husband to get the deductions for those expenses, which would not have been available if he was not a true employee. Now, that case, as you may recall, we had solid records of the taxpayer's spouse's work in the business, what he did. He seemed credible, made perfect sense. There were detailed records in place. But it's important to remember that in that case, even with that factual background, the IRS still chose to litigate the case. So the IRS is definitely, I believe we could say, sensitive on this issue, that there is a potential issue. Therefore, it becomes very important for your clients to avoid the bad fact situations, the five situations outlined by the tax court in Alexander, to make sure that we actually dot our I's, cross our T's. There is always going to be skepticism about the payments made to a close relative. Because of that, failing to follow all the formalities really can break against the taxpayer. In the case of Alexander, let's remember that that was the formality, that was the actual reason the court gave for the decision it came down with. So your clients who are looking to hire their children out or looking to have the children work in the business need to understand the importance of documenting what goes on. They also need to just avoid the smell test. It's probably not good to have every one of your four children get the same wage and get the same payment in total salary for the year. It's probably not good to have that amount just perfectly be the amount they could get tax-free. Or it's probably not good to have that amount be perfectly the amount that would fund the IRA or the Roth IRA that would allow that to happen. It might be very useful to have the children each end up at a different wage area and to make sure there are detailed records and certainly to make sure that all the payroll reports are filed and everything's reported properly and that you don't go, oops, I forgot to do a W-2 on my son. That's a bad fact pattern in this case. Well, this is the tax update again for this week. I am going to be now traveling out of town here coming up shortly. I'll be in Bismarck, North Dakota beginning next Saturday, a week from today's podcast. We usually try to get the podcast up on Saturday morning at the latest. So hopefully about a week from the time you're listening to this, I will be in Bismarck, North Dakota. We'll try and get an updated podcast up for that week and the following week because I'll be in Bismarck the whole week. So we'll try and get things in place. It may get a little iffy and dicey, but we'll try and see how things work. If not, hopefully I'll get back to you somewhere before the middle of September, and we'll get things running. Coming up, as I've noted before, September 18th, I will be in Novi, Michigan, doing a presentation again on construction contractors for an 8-hour CPE course. And then coming up the next week, on the 25th, a week later, I'll be in Roanoke, Virginia for the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference one more time, a technology presentation. And 2 days after that, I'll be in Memphis, Tennessee doing a presentation on employee benefit plans. So I'm going to be around and traveling a bit. Again, reminder that the tax update is brought to you by Lineberg Services on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Visit them there to discover what you can get access to if you subscribe to their services, the newsletters, and the information make available. Again, they're on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. And so for now, and hopefully I'll get to you a couple of podcasts in the interim, but at least maybe until the middle of September, this has been Tax Update for the week of August the 26th, 2006.